It's the State Capitol Report on the morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Kate Archer Kent, and the Wisconsin Eye Public Affairs Network is just like C-SPAN, an independent nonprofit broadcasting as much as it can at the Capitol, but it's just for Wisconsin. With a funding plan now in place to help this public service, let's find out more about how this C-SPAN but just for Wisconsin operates. And you can call in with a question or share your views, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email's always available to you anytime, ideas@WPR.org. John Hankus is president and CEO of the Wisconsin Eye Public Affairs Network, also known as WISEye. And John, welcome to the Ideas Network.
It's a wonderful morning. Thanks for the opportunity. Appreciate it, Lee. Thanks.
Yeah, welcome. And is my comparison apt? How does Wisconsin Eye compare to C-SPAN, John?
Well, we often refer to Wisconsin Eye as the state's version of C-SPAN. So on that count, you're absolutely right on. We're different in a few ways. One is that we are not funded in whole or largely by state government or any one large entity. You know, C-SPAN out in D.C. was created as a product of the cable TV industry, and they're still pretty heavily involved. We'd like to think that we do it a little bit better because we have a little bit more independence, but it's a very close comparison, yes.
And give us some idea, John, what a day in the life at Wisconsin Eye is like, that work happening behind the scenes to figure out how you're going to broadcast the hearings, the floor sessions, and everything else that's taking place at the Capitol.
It's a day-to-day challenge. We have a small production staff, and they work incredibly hard. We are under contract with the Wisconsin legislature, with both houses, the Senate and the Assembly. And that contract gives us the access to have the cameras installed. We are required to make sure that we produce live coverage of the floor sessions, all of the Joint Finance Committee hearings during budget years, and then a number of the committee hearings. So we're not bound to cover everything. So to your question, on a busy day in the Capitol, when there might be 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 events going on, we have to make a call based on what are we required, first and foremost, to cover. And then secondarily, it's a bit of a subjective judgment as to whether we cover the Assembly hearing on this or the Senate hearing on that. So we get a little bit of pushback. Why didn't you cover my committee hearing? But all in all, we cover the Capitol pretty thoroughly on a day-to-day basis, even on those busy days. And what's really interesting to manage is we have the capacity right now, Lee, to fully produce 2 live streams from the Capitol. And by that, I mean we can drop in real time the lower third graphics and give a little bit more enrichment to what you see on your monitor or on your TV set. We can also produce up to 3 additional live streams, but without those further enhancements. So on a busy day, there might be 8 or 9 events. We can produce 5 in real time live. Now, with the endowment campaign in place, we achieve that endowment goal, and we'll be able to ramp those numbers up. I mean, we're already planning a year and a half down the road to take those 2 fully produced programs up to 4 and take the total number up to 8 or 9. Obviously, that involves more equipment, more gear, additional staff. But our mission is to, as best we can and as thoroughly as we can, provide citizens with access to what's happening in the Capitol.
We're talking about the Wisconsin Eye Public Affairs Network, and our guest is the network president and CEO, John Hankus. And you can join our conversation with your questions. If you've used Wisconsin Eye in the past, your comments, 1-800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. So you mentioned this new funding agreement. WISEye is set to receive $10 million in state tax dollars. That is, if the network can match the dollar amount in private donations, John. So lawmakers approved this funding last May. Why does WISEye need this state? I think you kind of answered that, but you know, why do you see increasing the access to the capital providing for the state?
Well, when we were first started and went on the air in May in 2007, it became very evident to us that our primary audience, those who used it most often, it was an effective tool for state elected officials, for lobbyists, for advocacy groups, the news media, local government officials. But over time, more and more, there seems to be this growing interest in politics, in elections, in election outcomes. We are seeing more and more just regular citizen engagement in viewing the network. So we made a case with the legislature. You've not supported us in the past, other than one time prior to the pandemic when we needed to replace the cameras in the Capitol, and the state participated in partially funding that effort along with a mix of private dollars. And then in the pandemic, when fundraising went absolutely in the tank, both the governor's administration and the legislature provided a needed shot in the arm. This is different. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to create a permanent endowment for Wisconsin Eye. And once achieved, that $20 million account will generate more than enough money to provide for the day-to-day operations as we currently exist. But just as significantly, perhaps more importantly, it allows us to really move the vision forward, make enhancements, increase access, do some things that we'd like to do, but we don't have the resources. I'll give you one example. Prior to pandemic, when fundraising was going pretty strong, we had additional dollars to do some documentary work, all under the umbrella of civic knowledge. And so we created a mini documentary series called Dealing with Dementia and went around the state talking with folks at all levels about this booming baby boom population into senior citizenship and the growing numbers of dementia and Alzheimer's, and how are we as communities and states dealing with that. It was pretty provocative, and it was very heart-rending with some of the stories that we told. We won some awards for that. And then on the heels of that, we did a full-blown documentary called Straightforward, The Truth About Addiction, where we told the story of five young 20-ish-year-old Wisconsinites of diverse backgrounds and experiences, all of whom were fighting through addiction to opioids. And I personally took that documentary to all school assemblies around the state and shared that with students. And we always would have a counselor with us or a pediatric neurologist, and we'd engage the kids in Q&A afterwards. And eyes were opened because it was a medically sound discussion of what happens to the teenage brain as it matures and why addiction becomes a lifelong challenge for these kids. So back to the point of the endowment, we will have excess funds beyond our operating budget to do some of this other really important work. So we're excited about the possibilities.
So the Wisconsin Eye is set to receive $10 million in state tax dollars. If you can match the dollar amount in private donations, what's the status of this matching grant program this morning, John?
It's a slow process.
Okay.
Wisconsin Eye is never first in line when it comes to charitable giving and putting our hand out and saying, please, would you? I mean, we're relatively a small, young organization when you compare us to other entities with full-blown fundraising staffs. I mean, it's essentially the board and myself on the road asking for consideration of funds. So here's the status. The very first gift to the endowment campaign was Chris Abley, the former Milwaukee County exec, whose family has a foundation called the Argosy Foundation. They made a $50,000 commitment. Well, immediately that becomes doubled in the endowment equation. The next three who participated at that same level of $50,000 were three of our unions in the state, the operating engineers, Local 139, the Carpenters Union, and the Laborers Union, which is really exciting to us because we want balance in this funding as well. Not that it would have influence in programming decisions, but we feel it's really important, just like our coverage, to extend balance and fair play. Right now, there's over $3 million in active asks that are under consideration around the state. And this would be individuals, foundations, national foundations, and businesses. And the strategy moving forward is we've kind of carved up the state, identified some potential leaders in each of those regions, and go for regional fundraising goals. And then the other strategy is we are engaging and collaborating with a number of sectors within the economy. These are all sectors that are concerned about public policy and regulation, and they have state issues, and they have lobbyists. So we're looking at the utility sector, the insurance, the legal, the technology, manufacturing, and the hospitality sectors as participants in this fundraising campaign as well. Bottom line, it's going well. It's a slow process.
Are you confident we're going to get there?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I am absolutely confident.
The
value is there. And here's one evidence, Lee, of what's happening. Since the pandemic, viewership of Wisconsin Eye, we have had over 750,000 live and on-demand views of Wisconsin Eye programming in the last 3 years. 200,000 unique visitors. Our best performing year was last year, which was double what it was in 2021, which was also a state budget year. And last year, just in October, we achieved our highest viewed live program of 27,000 viewers. And that was the Joint Committee on Employment Relations, which was discussing the UW system pay increases, and Assembly Speaker Voss on the diversity, equity, and inclusion issue. So interest is growing, and with interest growing, our brand is growing and awareness is growing. And we believe that that $20 million goal is achievable.
You're listening to the State Capitol Report, and our guest is John Henkes, President and CEO of Wisconsin Eye. You can call in with your questions, thoughts about the Wisconsin Eye Public Affairs Network and how you use it, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and our guest is President and CEO of Wisconsin Eye, John Henkes. John's been with Wisconsin Eye since the very beginning, co-founding the nonprofit that began broadcasting in 2007. Still time for your comments or questions for John at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And John, we got a big election year this year. We've got the Republican National Convention coming to Milwaukee in July. How is Wisconsin Eye preparing for the upcoming convention and elections?
Let's start with the latter first. We have a history now of providing unique campaign coverage in the form of in-depth 20-minute interviews, which we invite participation by every candidate in the general election running for statewide and federal office. And the participation rate this last time around was about 86%. So we go to about 10 or 11 different locations around the state. We sit down and we ask and get to know the candidates and put their positions out. We share that then with Wisconsin Public Broadcasting, with the Wisconsin League of Women Voters, with commercial news media, all in our commitment to help voters better understand who these folks are beyond sound bites and TV commercials. So we'll do that again this year. And then with regard to the Republican National Convention, we're still planning what our focus will be. We don't want to be just like every other media entity covering the event. So we're working to have access to the Wisconsin delegation on a daily, sometimes twice a day basis, where we can talk with convention delegates. We also plan to do some enrichment of, you know, what goes into all of this, the platform, the positions, what are the issues. And then in the spirit of balance and fair play, we will be working with those on the left side, the Democrat Party, to have their reactions and their inputs as well. So the convention is still a work in progress. We want to be different. We want to provide something that's Wisconsin focused, and we'll see what pops. But we got bright people and folks helping us to think through that piece of it.
Yeah, last year before the primary election for State Supreme Court, Wisconsin, I interviewed three of the four candidates running for an open seat there. And let's listen here to the part of the network's interview with the eventual winner, Janet Protasiewicz.
My judicial identity is for always for fairness, for integrity, for anybody coming in front of me anytime to know that they're going to get a fair shot, to know that I'm going to look at the law, to know that I'm going to be independent.
John, Wisconsin I was unable to interview one of the candidates, Jennifer Darrow, a Waukesha County judge. And when it comes to, you know, access, how do you fairly cover a candidate who may be unavailable to interview?
It's their choice to participate or not. I do remember with that particular candidate, we offered to come on site, and it was a campaign management decision to not participate in that interview. And there's really nothing we can do at that point. I mean, when you extend multiple opportunities to a candidate to either come to Madison or we'll meet you where you would like us to meet you, there's not much you can do, Lee. You give it your best shot.
In a bigger picture, in the media overall, how do you defend the network against accusations of bias or political bias, and how do you shoot right down the middle?
Again, it's day to day. Here's the rub. We will hear from the left side that we're leaning right, and we hear from the right side that we're leaning left. And we say, wonderful, we're doing our job. But the reality is the Republicans are running the agenda in the state legislature. So the temperature and the tone is set by the GOP. And we're bound to be there to cover official state proceedings. Now, in the sense of balance and fair play, we do a whole lot more than just cover those required official state proceedings. Last year, in addition to those proceedings, so floor sessions, committee hearings, we covered 430 events in addition, news conferences, rotary speeches, state bar mock trial, but a whole lot of things that wrap around state policy. And I can tell you, we ran the numbers of all of those events. Our board considered 245 of the 430 to be neutral, 105 leaning toward the Democrat side, and 80 leaning toward the Republican side. So in addition, then we do studio interviews beyond that other ancillary coverage. Last year, we interviewed in studio 51 individuals involved in state policy. 24 of those we considered to be neutral, such as having the head of the DNR's deer management program come in the fall and talk about the deer herd. So 24 neutral, 15 Democrat-leaning, 12 Republican-leaning. We are really attentive to the sense of balance and fair play. And as it relates to the state capitol coverage, the key words there are access, transparency, consistent coverage. As it relates to those other events, it's all about fair play and balance and accuracy. And then as it relates to the studio interviews, it's about diversity of opinion and civil dialogue. We don't want people yelling at each other. We don't want name calling. We moderate those conversations so that they truly are civil, instructional, informative, and hopefully memorable.
Hey, John, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
We appreciate the opportunity. Thanks so much.
John Henkes is president and CEO of Wisconsin Eye. You're listening to the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is the Ideas Network. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and evictions are on the rise in Wisconsin. So what resources are available for families who find themselves facing the real threat of homelessness? What policies could be implemented to help prevent the threat of evictions in the first place? We'd appreciate your comments, questions, 800-642-1234 to join the show, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Our guest, Megan Meachin, Executive Director of the Community Action Coalition of South Central Wisconsin. And Megan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you.
Also joining us, Hannah Renfro, Executive Director of the Tenant Resource Center in Madison. Hannah, welcome to you.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Yeah, Megan, I'll start with you. At the end of January, the Wisconsin Eviction Data Project reported more than 28,000 eviction filings across the state in 2023. That's up more than 2,300 eviction filings than the year prior. During the first 2 months of this year, state courts received an estimated 5,000 eviction filings, and that's up 300 cases from the same period a year ago. So, Megan, from the perspective of the Community Action Coalition of South Central Wisconsin, what are the big reasons we're seeing the rise in these evictions?
That's a great question. I think it has a lot to do with the increasing costs of rent. And I think also that it has to do with ending of programs of assistance that were happening during COVID, where individuals who were having to choose between paying the higher costs of rent and food could gather that assistance in the community a lot easier than they can today. A lot of the programs that were implemented during the hard times of COVID have ended, and households still are in need because incomes are not meeting the needs of renters throughout the state of Wisconsin.
And Hannah, what about the perspective of the Tenant Resource Center in Madison? What are some of the reasons we're seeing the rise in evictions today?
Really, some of the same reasons that Megan mentioned: increased rent, also just continued increased cost of living for so many families. Groceries are very expensive for all of us. Childcare expenses. There's still so many lingering increased costs of living from COVID that everyone is trying to manage. And in Dane County, about 50% of renters are already what's called cost burning, meaning they spend more than 30% of their income on rent. So if you have to take a week off work, you're falling behind so easily on rent, much less if the rent is increasing.
And you said that it's about 50% are cost burdened with rent
in the Madison metro area. Yes.
Hannah, what about the federal moratorium on evictions, which expired more than a few years ago now? This moratorium explain some of the trajectory of evictions we see today?
Not necessarily. I mean, we have because that expired quite a while ago now, and we have had in Dane County a really robust rental assistance program that's been available to tenants. We have a rental assistance program that is available for tenants who have an eviction filing in Dane County right now. But that moratorium has expired long enough ago now that it's not really having so much an effect anymore.
We're talking about rising eviction cases with Megan Meachin at the Community Action Coalition of South Central Wisconsin and Hannah Renfro at the Tenant Resource Center in Madison. We invite you with your questions or comments to join our conversation. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. And Megan, the Community Action Coalition of South Central Wisconsin helps families facing eviction, but are you able to keep up with the pace of need?
Absolutely not. That's a great question. We actually assist households in Dane, Jefferson, and Waukesha counties. We have a bunch of different programs, but I will state that not one program fits every family. Each household that we serve individually comes with needs, and we're lucky enough that we have wonderful partners like United Way, the Predilin Foundation, and these types of community partners who are out willing to assist and allow us to provide case management and what we call prevention assistance, where we can step into a household who may be having an emergency and we're able to assist with rental assistance so that they can maintain their housing. It costs a lot less to keep somebody in their housing than it does to evict them and then have those households try to find new housing. What really happens with our programs, on average, we are exceeding the numbers we should be serving. There's never going to be enough with what we're seeing in the rental market right now.
Hannah Renfro from the Tenant Resource Center in Madison. Last May, the Dane County Coronavirus Rental Program stopped accepting applications as federal funding ran low. What sort of legal assistance to renters and landlords have you continued to provide to head off evictions in your community?
Yeah, thanks for that question. They ended the program, the CORE program, as we were calling it, in Dane County. But the Tenant Resource Center, we still have federal emergency aid funds for tenants who have an eviction filing. So we are averaging $250,000 roughly a week in rental and utility assistance to households in Dane County. So we still have those funds available for income and otherwise eligible tenants. So we really encourage anyone who has an eviction filing to come in Dane County to come see us in our office as soon as they get that filing so that we can find out ways that we can help them.
Hannah, when do Wisconsin state laws allow landlords to evict tenants? What are the rules there?
Well, it's a very nuanced question. Huh. So it really depends on the situation. But tenants can be, as far as non-payment of rent is concerned, as soon as there is any non-payment of the full amount of rent, a tenant may receive a termination notice, frequently called like a 5-day notice, depending on lots of other circumstances. And if the tenant does not pay that rent during that period of time, then a landlord, again, depending on the situation, could file an eviction at that point and then go through the court process. But a tenant cannot be evicted from their home unless a judge orders that. They have to go through the court process. So a landlord cannot just change the locks. The landlord cannot engage in like a self-help eviction. They have to go through the court process in order to evict a tenant.
Megan Meachin, what's this court process like and how long can that take? What's it like for the tenant and how long can it take?
I think that's actually a great question for Hannah. Okay. Hannah and I actually worked together on the CORE program. Community Action Coalition was able to distribute over $30 million just alone in the city of Madison to help prevent evictions. The partnership that we were able to experience during CORE was very essential. We worked together with Tenant Resource Center. We helped households who were still maintaining their housing. Any household that was going through eviction or faced with eviction was then turned over to our partners at Tenant Resource Center who helped them through that type of process.
What's that legal process like, Hannah?
Yeah, so a landlord has to file and serve the tenant with the summons and complaint. We find that frequently tenants don't know about that initial hearing. And a part of that is that there are in Dane County, those initial hearings are virtual. And so we notify in addition to being served those papers, but Tenant Resource Center, we contact every single person with an eviction filing to let them know that they have a filing. This is something that we have been doing for many years, to let them know that they have a filing and give them information about how they can appear for that hearing or that trial.
How and often does it come as a surprise to them that they're facing? I mean, is this when you contact them, do they know or do they find out through you sometimes?
There are a lot of households who are surprised by it. And this can happen because the tenant has moved and the landlord didn't realize that they had moved. This happens. We have seen several cases where somebody is there in the hospital when this filing happens and the whole eviction process happens and they didn't even realize it. We've had several households where the person, they are incarcerated. So we do a lot of work, again, like with, as Megan mentioned, so many partners in the organizations that are in the community that are doing really amazing work. But we really try to get in touch with whoever, a caseworker, somebody who is and connected with a household when we can't reach them directly, so that they know that this filing is happening so that they can try to appear. And if they weren't able to appear, providing them with information about how they could possibly reopen the case. And in those situations, we also partner with four legal organizations. And we provide funding to those legal organizations so that they can represent tenants free of charge. And those are situations where we may try to get the tenant represented by an attorney who could help them.
That's Hannah Renfro, Executive Director of the Tenant Resource Center in Madison. Also joining us, Megan Meachin, Executive Director of the Community Action Coalition of South Central Wisconsin. We invite you to the conversation as well for our State Capitol Report this hour at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Megan, we've talked a lot so far about the intervention that it can take place to help prevent people who are facing evictions, to help prevent homelessness. But what about prevention of ever getting that far? What sort of policies can help nip this in the bud so you don't have to deal with eviction notices, so tenants aren't facing the possibility of homelessness? What can be done to prevent all this?
That's a great question. I truly, honestly think it comes down to funds and case management and partners working together. I think that landlords have the right. They run a business. It's understandable that they need to also pay their bills. But what it comes down to is we do have these households who need assistance. And we have community partners who can effectively go in and help with such things as paying that prevention assistance, also providing landlord-tenant mediation services. I think that there also are a lot of households that are doubled up right now, in a sense where one or two households are sharing a typical two-bedroom unit just because they need to be able to afford those. There's a lot of talk around needing to make sure that households or units that are set aside for 30% income households, basically low-income households, need to be set aside for those households so that they have access to housing that they can actually truly afford in the community.
Megan Meachin, Executive Director of the Community Action Coalition of South Central Wisconsin, also joining us. Hannah Renfro, Executive Director of the Tenant Resource Center in Madison. And you are invited as well at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You're listening to the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn on the Ideas Network. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're talking about the growth in evictions across Wisconsin, the resources available to renters, and the policies that could prevent evictions and keep families in their homes. Our guests, Megan Meachin, Executive Director of the Community Action Coalition of South Central Wisconsin, and Hannah Renfro, Executive Director of the Tenant Resource Center in Madison. Your questions and comments always welcome here in the morning, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Hannah Renfro, how frequently do eviction filings result in a judge ordering a tenant to leave a property? The eviction notice is one thing, but the forced eviction is another. How common is it?
We see in Dane County default judgments. I can't remember the exact number off the top of my head, but we have a, but it is a about, I think there's about 200 out of the 200 in over about 2,500 filings. And these can happen for a variety of reasons. The judge, a default judgment is like happens is there about 95% of the judgments are default judgments. And that's the result of a tenant not being present at one of the hearings that they have scheduled. And that, so that is the primary reason that we see judgments occur in Dane County. And that can be the reasons that we talked about frequently. We see is somebody does not know about their hearing. And if a case is set over and there are multiple hearings, every single time there is a hearing scheduled. And if somebody has difficulty coming to that hearing, there is a risk at that point of there being a default judgment. So we really emphasize at the Tenant Resource Center, we have staff who are in contact, as I said earlier, with every single person who has a filing. And even on the day of the eviction court hearings, which are held on Tuesday and Wednesdays in Dane County, we have staff who are calling, texting, sometimes going to somebody's house to make sure that they know that they have a hearing scheduled, what time it is and how they can log in. And folks can also come to our office. We have an eviction court room where tenants can come to our office. We can help them log on to Zoom so that they are able to attend their hearing.
What about the landlords in this equation? Hannah, from your perspective, where do the laws fall when it comes to this relationship between landlords and tenants? And who gets the benefit of the doubt here as you see it?
Well, I mean, Wisconsin is very much a landlord-friendly state. Several years ago, many of the local landlord-tenant laws were preempted by state law, saying that local governments could not enact their own landlord-tenant laws. So it's definitely ways in favor of the landlords policy-wise, but then it's also just the power imbalance itself. So a tenant who has a filing or a question about their lease or a complaint, their housing is at risk. So there's just an inherent power imbalance. One of the things that we had that has been really an important part of our eviction diversion and defense partnership program that started in COVID is providing tenants with legal representation to try to balance that, to try to weigh on the tenant side that power imbalance. So we have, I think our last reporting was about 25% of tenants were represented in eviction court as opposed to maybe 1% prior to this partnership existing.
Wow. Megan Meachin, once you have an eviction judgment on your record, what does that mean when it comes time to trying to find another place to rent or an apartment? How difficult is it?
Yeah, it becomes very difficult. In fact, typically with what we're looking at with the housing inventory and renter inventory within the three communities and counties that we serve, is that we found that landlords have a lot of opportunities to pick and choose who they want to rent to. If you're coming to the door already with an eviction on your record, landlords are able to pull 1 to 15 other applications that don't possibly have an eviction on their record. Destabilizing the community, if we're able to assist with prevention and actually keep somebody in their unit, they need maybe 1 to 3 months of assistance with case management where they can determine that they are then stabilized in the community. Whereas trying to rehouse somebody or have them leave homelessness back into housing takes about an average of 6 to 12 months. You have to remember that you're not only talking about trying to find a unit, but you're trying to stabilize in a new community. Find those community efforts around you that are going to help you, whether it be the local school, whether it be where even the grocery store is, or store or transportation. There's a lot of issues that come up with trying to rehouse a household and stabilize them in their community.
That's Megan Meachin from the Community Action Coalition of South Central Wisconsin. Also joining us, Hannah Renfro from the Tenant Resource Center in Madison. And you're listening to the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. Hannah, late last year, the Wisconsin Supreme Court reduced from 20 years to 2 years the amount of time most eviction records must be kept on state court websites. Does that limiting of access help renters at all as you see it?
Well, that Supreme Court rule is actually, it's not in effect yet.
Okay.
And there is some, yeah, there is some, there's not clarity at this point when it will be in effect. The other important piece of that is that that will apply only when there is not a money judgment, meaning that the tenant does not owe funds. So at this point, we don't know. I mean, it will definitely be a step in the right direction to help tenants, but we don't know how that is going to impact tenants yet.
It sounds like it may impact a very few, or at least not as many as you'd like to see in order to put a dent in the numbers of evictions in Wisconsin. Is that the expectation?
It's really difficult. You know, in this right now, there are, when somebody has an eviction filing and it is dismissed, it stays on that person's record online for 2 years. And it doesn't matter the reason that it is dismissed. It'll stay on their record. If they have a judgment of eviction, it can be on there for 20 years. So that can change somebody's life for their entire life when that happens. If they have, as Megan talked about, go trying to find new housing after that point. There are options that are available, particularly after a case has been dismissed, for tenants to motion the court to have their names redacted from CCAP, the online record. And we have seen our attorneys that are part of the our partnership here have done hundreds of those motions successfully for tenants to have their names redacted off of the record to help them find and sustain new housing.
Megan Meachin, I've got about a minute left here, but if there was one step Wisconsin could take towards lowering the number of evictions was in Wisconsin, what would it look like?
I will always push for more funding for these households. I will always push that households, if just because they're at the brink of eviction, you don't understand what caused that eviction to happen. And they are typically choosing between having to pay essential bills or an emergency bill that came up. There's a high percentage of households that are right on the edge of eviction every month. And if we're able to create programs where we can walk in with assistance and financial assistance, not just case management, to prevent that eviction from happening, we will see a lot of stabilization in the communities.
Hannah, if we took one step forward towards lowering our eviction rate, what would it be?
Absolutely agree with Megan. What we see so much is that individuals who are in a housing crisis, they have a crisis in so many other areas in their life. Mm-hmm. And so providing that financial assistance tied with case management services to help in households, that would absolutely make an enormous difference.
Hannah and Megan, thank you both for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Lee.
Thank you, Lee.
Hannah Renfro, Executive Director of the Tenant Resource Center in Madison, and Megan Meachin is the Executive Director of the Community Action Coalition of South Central Wisconsin, taking a look at the rise in evictions across the state and what can be done about it. This has been the State Capitol Report. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent this morning, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Listening to The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent, and the National Kidney Foundation estimates that in the U.S., 12 people a day die from kidney failure. There are simply not enough kidney donors to meet the needs of those waiting for a transplant, but perhaps that could all change following the first successful transplant of a kidney from a genetically modified pig. If you have experience with kidney disease and kidney treatments, we welcome your questions and comments and experiences here for the hour at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email available anytime. ideas@wpr.org. Our guest for the hour, Dr. Didier Mandelbrot, is the medical director of the UW Health Kidney Pancreas Transplantation Program. And Dr. Mandelbrot, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Also joining us this morning, Dr. Anna Gaddy is a nephrologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin and treats patients with chronic kidney disease. Dr. Gaddy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and Dr. Gaddy, I'll start with you. What was your reaction to the news about the very first of its kind of a genetically modified pig being used for a kidney transplant for a 62-year-old man?
I mean, everyone, I think, in the nephrology space was so excited to hear this. It's a tremendous program that did this. So you know that the planning and forethought was solid. And, you know, I'm sure Dr. Mandelbrot will talk more about this, but one of the real issues we run into with our patients who get kidney transplants is, one, there's not enough organs, but two, having to use immunosuppression to prevent rejection is a huge issue. And so the potential that we could use genetic modification to make more organs available through xenotransplantation or to perhaps circumvent some of those needs for immunosuppression is just a really exciting frontier for transplant.
Yeah. And what would this, if you are somebody, a patient with chronic kidney disease, how would you view this medical breakthrough?
So I would imagine that patients would be very hopeful because of this. I have many patients on dialysis who are waiting for a transplant. And of course, there's just a shortage of available organs. And so I think any breakthroughs that can help broaden the pool of organs available for donation is really exciting.
Dr. Mandelbrot, as a medical director of the UW Health Kidney Pancreas Transplantation Program, what were the reverberations for you in hearing about the very first of its kind genetically modified pig kidney transplant?
Yeah, it was a huge step forward, and the community is very excited about this. You know, the field of xenotransplantation, or, you know, the idea of transplanting organs from animals into humans, is old. The concept is old, really 40, 50 years ago. And longer, people have been talking about this and thinking and starting experiments. For many years at meetings, people would make the comment that xenotransplant is the future of transplantation, and it always will be the future of transplantation. There's this thought that it just was endless. We would keep looking for solutions. And now I think there's just a huge leap forward in optimism. This is a, you know, a successful xenotransplant, and it's obviously a first step. It's just one transplant. Everybody understands that further research is necessary to really refine the process to better define benefits as well as risks. There's just a great increase in optimism, and I think it'll have a huge impact in the coming years.
Dr. Mandelbrot, researcher from UW Health and the UW Center for Biomedical Swine Research and Innovation, were part of this team that genetically engineered the donor pig for Massachusetts General Hospital's patient. Why are pig organs a viable option for transplantation here? What is it about them?
Yeah, there are several factors that contribute. One is simply that the size of the pig's kidney is very well matched. It's very similar to the size of human kidneys. And it also turns out that pigs have a very short life cycle. So they're very amenable to breeding and to genetic modifications that can be done fairly quickly. Rather than having to make sort of one genetic modification and waiting years for that pig to breed, it's something that can be done rapidly. Then I think that the third big factor is that pigs are already, you know, there's pig farms already. Mm. You know, the world and the United States already consumes many pigs. So the idea of making pig farms of genetically modified pigs for the purpose of saving lives and doing transplants is sort of much more readily acceptable by society.
So according to the journal Nature, they say 69 pig genes were removed from this pig donor before the transplant into the 62-year-old man a couple of weeks ago. Why is that, Dr. Mandelbrot? What were they editing out there?
Yeah, so actually, many of the edits were editing out. Some were actually editing in. And there's actually three different categories of gene modifications. Some of the modifications were to get rid of sugar molecules on the pig organs that cause very rapid rejection. There were, for many years of research, really a barrier to doing transplants from animals. So several of those molecules on the surface of the organs were removed. But then a number of molecules were actually added in. And those molecules are molecules that basically, they're actually human molecules that suppress the immune system, suppress the recipient's immune response to those organs. And interestingly, the majority of the changes, 59 out of the 69 changes, were actually to remove potential viruses in the pig genome, because that's been one of the main concerns over the years from xenotransplantation, that potentially a virus that is found in pigs and is not harmful to pigs could potentially be transplanted along with those organs and then potentially become dangerous to humans. So 59 pig viruses that had incorporated into the genome were removed by this new technology, the CRISPR technology, that's allowed such major breakthroughs in terms of gene modifications.
That's Dr. Didier Mandelbrot, who is a medical director of the UW Health Kidney Pancreas Transplantation Program, also joining us this hour. Dr. Anna Gaddy, who is a nephrologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and we invite you with your questions, comments, and experiences with kidney disease at 800 and treatment at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. And Dr. Gaddy, how do we begin to weigh some of the ethical balances that may come into play when it comes to xenotransplantation here?
So the first thing that comes to my mind when I'm thinking about ethical issues with this transplant is that, you know, obviously we don't have data for how this organ's going to perform longitudinally. You know, we know that while pigs have a quicker life cycle, they also don't live as long as humans. And so I think there's a lot to be said for having 10 years of data to tell a patient, to assure them that, you know, the benefits of getting a transplant from a pig, not just in terms of it won't reject, but it will last as long as a human kidney would last. I think we're quite a ways from being able to give them that certainty. So that's the biggest one that comes to my mind. The other things that I think are could be issues are that, you know, right now getting a transplant from a human that's well matched is the gold standard. And so being very careful about how we use xenotransplant to extend our pool versus to replace our pool, and who we would be offering human organs to versus who we would be offering xenotransplant organs to. I think there's a lot of gray area there that we'll need to work through ethically.
Dr. Mandelbrot, what would need to happen before the Food and Drug Administration would approve pig kidney transplants, the likes of which we saw for the very first time here just a few weeks ago?
Yeah, if I could, just before I answer that, just go back to the ethical question, because I think it's an important one. And I think one of the, I agree with all the points Dr. Gaddy made, but one additional point to emphasize, because I looked this up a few days ago, every year, the United States consumes over 100 million pigs, so for food. And the idea here is that the entire, you know, waiting list for organs is on the order of 100,000. So, you know, it would be just essentially a drop in the bucket of additional pigs that would be used for purposes of saving lives. I think in the early days, and there still may be some concerns about the ethics of using animals, but that was one of the reasons why pigs were such a successful model, that there are already so many more pigs being, you know, consumed for bacon or ham than would be needed for saving lives. So I think that that's now felt to be a relatively minor concern.
Doctor, I appreciate that. And well, let me let's take a second here. And when we continue, we will get an answer to where the FDA goes from here when it comes to xenotransplantation. And the first of its kind, we just saw a couple weeks ago at Massachusetts General Hospital, where a 62-year-old man received a genetically modified kidney from a pig for the very first time. Our guest for the hour, Dr. Didier Mandelbrot, is the medical director of the UW Health Kidney and Pancreas Transplantation Program. And Dr. Anna Getty is a nephrologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin and volunteers with the National Kidney Foundation of Wisconsin. You're welcome here, too, at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're talking to two kidney specialists in Wisconsin about the latest advancements in treating kidney disease and the first of its kind successful transplant of a genetically modified pig kidney into a human patient just a few weeks ago. Our guest, Dr. Didier Mandelbrot, is the medical director of the UW Health Kidney and Pancreas Transplantation Program, and Dr. Anna Getty, nephrologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin, treating patients with chronic kidney disease. We welcome you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Dr. Mandelbrot, where we left off was the path that this xenotransplantation may take to getting FDA approval. What will that path look like, and what could the timeline be?
Yeah, so this particular transplant was done under what's generally called by the FDA the compassionate use. And the idea is that that's for a one time or a small number of experiments, if you will. And there's a number of steps that still need to go, that the field needs to go through before reaching FDA approval. There'd be a small number of individuals and then presumably a series of patients receiving xenotransplants, potentially even randomized controlled trials. So this is probably a timeline of years, which again, in the history of xenotransplantation, as many decades, is relatively short, but still it's required before any sort of treatment can be widely adopted.
Taking a step back here, Dr. Getty, when does a kidney go bad? What's considered an unhealthy kidney, and when is it important to get treatment here?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. So the burden of chronic kidney disease in the United States is just enormous. And the vast majority of people with chronic kidney disease don't know that they have it. So when I describe to patients that chronic kidney disease is a scarring type of process, it's until it reaches the very, very, very late stages, has no symptoms. And so it's really important that patients get routine primary care so that they can avoid not only the diseases that lead to chronic kidney disease, like hypertension and diabetes, but also that they can be screened for chronic kidney disease with a regular, on a regular schedule. And so chronic kidney disease happens for a variety of reasons, but by far the biggest contributors in the United States are diabetes and hypertension. And so there's really no symptoms until the kidney, it's a remarkable organ and can there's a lot of redundancy. And so it can really make up for some of its own shortcomings and hyperfiltrate, we say, for a long time. So you really wouldn't have any symptoms until you were almost to the point of no return. So primary care and screening is absolutely essential.
Dr. Mandelbrot, in January, just this past January, UW Health celebrated its second longest living kidney recipient. A 74-year-old Wisconsin woman is a functioning kidney that's actually older than she is at 98 years old. How long can a kidney function after a transplant, doctor?
Yeah, there's really no theoretical limit. That's a good example. We have a number of kidney transplant recipients whose kidneys have lasted, I think the record is 57 years, but we have a number that have lasted 40, 50 years. There's a number of factors that influence how long those kidneys can last. His episodes of rejection certainly contribute to kidneys lasting less long. Probably one of the biggest factors is actually other illnesses or comorbidities that the kidney transplant recipient has. So if they have hypertension and diabetes, those conditions can actually recur in the kidney transplant. But I think that, again, there's no theoretical limit. And patients that I see in clinic who have excellent kidney function after 20 years, I usually tell them that I expect the kidney to last at least another 20 years. There's again, no theoretical limit.
We're talking about kidney disease and transplants. Our guests are Dr. Didier Mandelbrot at UW Health and Dr. Hannah Gaddy from the Medical College of Wisconsin. And we welcome you to the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Dr. Gaddy, when do you typically recommend patients for a kidney transplant?
That's a great question. So we recommend patients who have been seeing a nephrologist longitudinally be referred for kidney transplant when their GFR, or roughly that percentage of kidney function, gets down to about 20%. There's always a sweet spot. What we're trying to do is ideally get them a transplant before they ever need dialysis to replace the function of their kidney. So we're always aiming to get patients listed and find them, do all the workup to be listed and make sure that they're a good, healthy transplant candidate, and then get them a transplant before their kidney actually gets to the point that it is not able to do its job anymore. So there's really a timing aspect of it that's best served if you've been seeing a nephrologist for a while.
And how does that timing come up against the transplant organ donor list?
That's a great question. So there's really, with all transplants, all organ transplants, there's you need to be sick enough that there's a greater benefit than risk to getting a transplant. And so if you've got some time left on your kidneys, it's always best to use the kidney that you have, or whatever organ you're talking about. It's always best to use the organ function that you have. And so you can imagine that, as Dr. Mandelbrot mentioned, there's a huge wait list in the United States for a kidney. And so if patients are not able to find a relative or a friend to donate a kidney to them, then they're put on a list where they wait for a donor who has deceased. And so, of course, that's a very difficult thing to estimate timing for. And certain patients have conditions that make them, you know, a more difficult blood type, or maybe a difficult body size to match, that makes them a harder candidate to get matched. So that's some of where specialty nephrology care comes into play, is that your nephrologist can estimate your risk of how hard you would be as a candidate and refer you slightly earlier. For example, I have some patients who I know anatomically, because they've had surgeries in their abdomen, are going to be a little bit more challenging to find a good transplant for. And so I refer those patients slightly earlier than I would, for example, a completely anatomically normal patient. Just an example.
Yeah, and that makes sense. And Dr. Mandelbrot, Dr. Gaddy talks about how sick a patient has to be before they'd recommend a kidney transplant. But how do you determine whether a patient is healthy enough to receive a kidney transplant?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, the central problem that you alluded to in your introduction is really the shortage of kidneys to transplant. And another way of thinking about that, or the result of that, is that waiting times for kidney transplants are really very long, depending on your blood type and historically the region of the country. The waiting lists are on the order of 3 to 6 years. Mm. And so some patients, and in particular, actually, this one patient who was transplanted recently at Mass General was doing so badly with dialysis that he was really motivated to go ahead and participate in this experiment, because he was he had been both on dialysis and had a transplant and then was back on dialysis. And here he really felt that he essentially couldn't take it anymore for another 5 years. The promise of xenotransplantation is to basically eliminate the waiting list. Unfortunately, the waiting list, again, is such a central problem. Every year, you know, thousands of patients die waiting for an organ because of the organ shortage. So having an essentially unlimited supply of organs would mean that all these patients, instead of declining as they're waiting for an organ would be able to be transplanted promptly. So, but to go back to your question, there still is, there probably are a number of patients who would not be able to tolerate the transplant just for technical reasons.
Dr. Mandelbrot, we'll have to, I'm sorry, we got a news coming up here, and we will get back to our conversation this hour, taking a look at the treatments of kidney disease, the diagnosis, and the prevention of kidney disease as well, and organ transplantation. We invite you to the conversation, 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent. Now that we have our first successful transplant of a genetically modified pig kidney into a patient dying from kidney failure, what does the future hold for treating kidney disease and for organ transplants? Our guest this hour, Dr. Didier Mandelbrot, Medical Director of the UW Health Kidney and Pancreas Transplantation Program, and Dr. Anna Gaddy, nephrologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She also volunteers with the National Kidney Foundation of Wisconsin. And we invite you to our conversation as well at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Gary and Rippon, we go to you next. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. On January 8 of this year, I had one of my kidneys removed, not for purposes of transplantation. So my question is there some particular things I should be doing to try to keep the other one that I still have?
I bet there are, Gary, and let's ask Dr. Gaddy just that. Dr. Gaddy, Gary's down to one kidney after his surgery to start this year. How should he go forward and protect it?
Great question, Gary. I'm glad your mind is on this, and I'm glad you're doing well after your surgery. So the biggest things, you know, you have two kidneys, and as we always say, you can live just fine with one. But the things that you need to be careful for are to make sure that that kidney stays as healthy as possible. And so, as always, that the biggest thing is making sure you're seeing your doctor regularly to make sure that your blood pressure and your blood sugar are well controlled and that you're not developing any other health issues, sort of screening to make sure that that kidney is staying healthy with urine and blood tests every year. The things you can do are to make sure that you're not putting yourself in situations where you're becoming volume depleted or what we think of as dehydrated. So if you're out working in the hot sun this summer, or if you're out on a boat or golfing, make sure that you are eating enough, that you're staying in the shade, that you're drinking enough water. If you start to feel faint, make sure you get inside of the shade and get rehydrated quickly. And if you're getting sick, if you get, for example, a GI bug and you start to vomit or have diarrhea and you're feeling, you know, dizzy or like you're not able to keep food down, have a very low threshold. You don't muscle through those types of situations the way you maybe did previously. Go straight to the emergency room and get some IV fluids for those situations. You just have to baby your kidney a bit more. And the things that your kidney really hates are times when your blood pressure is dangerously low. So be on the lookout for those. And then long-term, taking care of yourself, making sure that you're eating healthy foods so that you don't develop diabetes or high blood pressure, avoiding salt as much as possible, and trying to minimize how much non-steroidal medications you use, which would be Advil, ibuprofen, Motrin, or Aleve, which is naproxen.
Thank you for that. And Gary, thank you for the call at 1-800-642-1234. Dr. Mandelbrot, before the news, we were talking about how you thread that needle where a patient who is sick enough to need a transplant but healthy enough to receive one in a way that would be successful. I want to return to that because you oversee the UW Health Kidney and Pancreas Transplantation Program, and you'd reach 12,000 kidney donations back in 2022. So with that in mind, what is your program doing to improve transplant outcomes, and how does, you know, deciding who should be a recipient of a transplant play into that?
Yeah, so, you know, our report of our long history of kidney transplants, one of the main findings, which we confirmed what others have found, is that outcomes from transplantation have really improved over the decades. Outcomes from dialysis, as it turns out, have also improved over the decades. But in general, for most patients with kidney failure, transplantation is a better option. There's still some, and the promise of xenotransplantation is to make dialysis much less common. The idea is if we could supply organs to that 100,000 or so patients waiting for a kidney, those 100,000 or so patients would not need to be on dialysis. But there are still some patients who really are too sick to be able to benefit from kidney transplantation. And that's one of the things that's, we spend a lot of time evaluating patients and trying to improve their health, whether it's to improve the status of any heart disease they might have, or vascular disease, or lung disease, to get them to the point where they would be healthy enough to be able to get through the surgery itself. Yeah, so xenotransplantation would not solve those risks that are associated with the transplant procedure itself. Again, we spend a lot of time and effort trying to improve the status of patients so that they can get those long-term benefits of transplant and make those long-term benefits worth the short-term risks, because there always is some short-term risk associated with the surgical procedure itself.
Sure, and I want to take a moment to look at dialysis. And Dr. Gadia, I'll start with you here. You prescribe dialysis to some of your chronic kidney disease patients. How frequently do they need dialysis?
So most people who need dialysis need it 3 times per week. That's the standard in this country. In some countries, we do up to 5 times a week. And it basically, you know, when you're doing dialysis, you're trying to do the kidney's job. What the kidney does 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, normally we're trying to squeeze into a short enough period of time that people can still live a life. And so for most patients, that's 3 times per week at 4 hours per session. So it's 12 hours plus, you know, getting there, getting back. And a lot of patients don't feel great after dialysis, so that's kind of the day for them. So it winds up really being 3 full days per week of, we often describe it as having a part-time job.
It sounds like it could be close to a full-time job. Dr. Mandelbrot, there are some patients who survive through dialysis for more than 30 years. Is long-term dialysis improving?
Yeah, definitely. You know, over the years, I have met patients who had been on dialysis even 30 or 40 years.
Wow. Had
been, you know, worked full-time as doctors and lawyers and raised families, but those are generally the exception. You know, we roughly say that dialysis, half of patients on dialysis die after 5 years. So there's, despite, you know, significant improvements over time of dialysis treatments, it's still a difficult life, and most people struggle with dialysis. So again, that's why so often transplantation is a much better solution.
Dr. Gadia, once you are on dialysis, is there a way to wean yourself off of it?
That's an interesting question. I saw the article about progressive weaning of patients from dialysis, and I just want to clarify that weaning patients off dialysis is useful for a particular type of kidney injury that we call an acute kidney injury. And that happens when someone has something short-term happen, when they were previously very healthy, and then they get in, for example, a car accident, and their kidney is stunned, and they need dialysis to do the kidney's job while the kidney is waking up. That is not the case in patients who have chronic kidney disease, whose kidneys have been, as I said, scarring over the process of decades. For the vast majority of patients, once they get on dialysis from chronic kidney disease, they need dialysis forever until they can get a kidney transplant. There are some patients with acute kidney injury who we can basically, their kidneys start to wake up, and then we can slow down or wean or just stop altogether the dialysis therapy after time.
Dr. Anna Gadi from the Medical College of Wisconsin, also joining us, Dr. Didier Mandelbrot from UW Health. And you are invited as well at 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. And before we go back to your calls, Dr. Mandelbrot, what about at-home dialysis? Is this something that is up and coming? Is this a new technology that could be useful for folks who rely on dialysis 3 times a week?
Yeah, it's, it's not exactly new. The concept's been around, I think, on the order of 30 years. But its adoption has continued to increase. Many and it does seem to provide better outcomes and better quality of life than so-called in-center hemodialysis. You know, there's, I guess, two types of home dialysis. One is peritoneal dialysis, and the other is home hemodialysis. And they are associated with better quality of life, more freedom, less, you know, requirement to get to a transplant center at a specific time and dialyze at a specific time. So in general, the outcomes of home hemodialysis seem to be better than the outcomes of in-center hemodialysis. And the nephrology community, as well as the government, have been encouraging the increased use of home hemodialysis now for a number of years. So I think the technology is there. I think a lot of the barriers now have to do with reimbursement and logistics. But still, in general, a transplant will provide better outcomes than even home hemodialysis.
Back to the phones now, where Ray in Milwaukee standing by. Ray, good morning.
Good morning. I want to speak about something that you really don't hear about at all for some reason. Excess deaths in the United States 2022-2023 was over 110,000 excess deaths. That's deaths above the normal rate. The insurance companies are freaking out about this, but for some reason, our government never talks about it, but I wonder how that impacts availability for organ donors, because most of these excess deaths in these 2 years that I'm speaking of have been young, healthy people who would be excellent candidates to donate an organ.
Interesting, Ray. I hadn't even thought of that. And Dr. Mandelbrot, I'll turn to you as the medical director of the UW Health Kidney Pancreas Transplantation Programs. Are unexpected deaths in the U.S., does that play a role in our transplant system?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, it does. You know, there are a number of causes for those excess deaths. You know, during the COVID pandemic, clearly that was one major factor. The narcotic deaths, overdoses, unfortunately, there's still an epidemic. Climate change has increased heat-related deaths. As the caller points out, some of those deaths are in young, healthy people. And so that probably has contributed in part to the increased number of deceased donor transplants that have been performed in recent years. So from the transplant side of the coin, you know, we look at curves and the number of deceased donor transplants have increased, you know, a little bit every year, some ups and downs, but overall the trend has been to increase. But the unfortunate other side, of course, is that that's due to increased deaths among the population as well. Some of it is, of course, better utilization of organs. We'd like to think that we continue to improve on that side, that's true that the excess deaths have contributed to that.
Dr. Mandelbrot from the UW Health Kidney Pancreas Transplantation Program, also joining us for this hour, Dr. Anna Gaddy, nephrologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and there's still time for you as well at 1-800-642-1234. Questions and comments about kidney disease, treatments, and transplantation? Join us before our hour is up at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we just don't know how many people are living with kidney disease. And Dr. Gaddy mentioned it. It's because, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, as many as 9 in 10 adults in the U.S. who have kidney disease don't know it. Well, then how do you treat it? We're talking about our kidneys this morning with our guest, Dr. Didier Mandelbrot, who oversees the UW Health Kidney and Pancreas Transplantation Program, and Dr. Anna Gaddy, who is a nephrologist with the Medical College of Wisconsin. And we invite you to our conversation as well at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to James in Door County next. James, good morning.
Good morning. Hi, I'm a retired general surgeon, and when I was in training in the 80s, transplantation, particularly kidney transplantation, wasn't really being done in the older population. So I'm wondering, what is the success rate now with renal transplantation in patients who are, say, over 65 years old?
Doctor?
Thank you, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, appreciate the question, doctor. Thank you. Dr. Mandelbrot, what's the success rate been for the older populations in these kidney transplants?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that the outcomes have been generally good. The trends, which have been shown by many others, as well as our recent report of our 12,000 transplants at UW, show that the average age of patients undergoing transplant has continued to increase. And in general, as you know, for any surgical procedure, we know that there's a difference between sort of chronological age, or the age on paper, and the physiological age, or you know, how much wear and tear there is on the body, if you will. And we know that somebody who's 75 but is able to exercise regularly and has limited, you know, heart disease, lung disease, et cetera, can do very well with the transplant, and can not only improve their quality of life, but often increase their length of life. And to bring it back to the xenotransplant question, there are patients that we've seen over the years who, you know, may be borderline candidates now, but if they're, say, you know, 80 years old and their expected wait time is 6 years, you know, the odds are that that patient would not be a good candidate by the time they receive the deceased donor organ. So the promise of xenotransplantation would be that we could look at a patient who's, say, 80 years old and say, well, you don't have to wait. You're an okay candidate now. We don't have to make any sort of assumptions or guesses about whether or not you might be a candidate in 5 years. And we could go ahead and do a transplant. So again, one of the many reasons why I think xenotransplantation would open doors for a lot of patients to be able to undergo transplantation.
Dr. Gaddy, got a question here from Sarah in La Crosse, who wants to know how we eat and drink affects our kidneys, and what can we eat and drink that would benefit our kidneys the most?
That's a great question. That's one I get a lot in clinic. So one of the things that I hear a lot, and I know this is really, really prominent in pop culture, is that drinking a lot of water is great for your kidneys. And that's a myth. Your body is really quite good at telling you when you need water. So the idea that drinking, you know, 5 liters of water a day is going to flush out your kidneys is not true. And so I would really encourage people to try to eat generally a healthful diet in portions that can sustain a healthy body weight and a healthy blood sugar, and avoiding salt above 2 grams per day. So I usually recommend that patients try to eat less than 2000 milligrams of sodium per day. And that is the best thing you can really do to keep your kidneys healthy. Other than that, focus on eating plant-based foods, eating a nice round diet with some vegetables, some lean protein, some fruits, some grains. But there's really not a diet that can prevent kidney disease. It's just whatever helps you maintain good blood sugars and good blood pressure. So for most people, avoiding excess salt in the diet above 2 grams of sodium per day is usually that top limit of what we want people consuming. And then drink to thirst.
Dusty and Madison, we go to you next. Good morning.
Hi, friends. My name is Dusty. I'm a 2-time kidney transplant recipient through UW-Madison. I was on hemodialysis, did some peritoneal at home. And actually, I'm in my 30s. I actually have a transplant from my dad, who's in his 60s. Oh. And so I just want to thank you all for the great work there. I did have a question about so we talked about the xenotransplantation. What about more of the mechanical kidney stuff? I've seen some stuff out of UC Davis about mechanical kidneys and then the internal membrane systems there. Is that something you guys are pursuing?
Dusty, glad to hear you're doing well. Dr. Mandelbrot, mechanical hardware for our kidneys.
Yeah, there's definitely interest in that approach as well. I'm not familiar with any research specifically on that at UW, although that doesn't 100% mean that there's none going on. UCSF and a number of other places across the country have been working on that. And it has various terms. Some people think of it as sort of portable dialysis or, yeah, an artificial mechanical kidney. It's still got a ways to go because the kidney does so many different things. In other words, it's not just the mechanics of a kidney, which is quite complex in terms of filtering water and electrolytes and, you know, retaining water and electrolytes when appropriate. But the kidney has a number of hormonal functions having to do with regulating calcium and phosphate, regulating red blood cell production, et cetera. So I think that's an important area of research. Clearly transplantation is already here and working. Although I don't have a crystal ball, I suspect that especially with some of these recent developments in xenotransplantation and the fact that those transplanted kidneys really seem to do everything that the kidney needs to do, I think that's probably more likely to have an impact in the coming years and decade than a mechanical kidney.
Thank you for the question, Dusty, and we are already down to our last minute. Dr. Gaddy, why should folks consider becoming a kidney donor today?
Oh, great question. Because as we've talked about, xenotransplantation is likely many, many years away for the general public and going prime time. But, you know, you really only need one of your two kidneys. If you are healthy, you can live a wonderful life with one kidney. It's obviously a big ask, but considering donating a kidney to a loved one or even to a stranger you don't know is a wonderful way to make a positive impact on the world. And Wisconsin has some great tax benefits for kidney donors and some great protections. But generally, it's just a really good deed.
Dr. Gaddy, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Dr. Mandelbrot, thank you as well to you. Really appreciate your time and information.
Thank you.
Didier Mandelbrot is the medical director of the UW Health Kidney and Pancreas Transplantation Program. Dr. Anna Gaddy is a nephrologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin and treats patients with chronic kidney disease. The Medical College of Wisconsin is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.